This recording is a production of Faith Builders. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2013, held at Faith Builders on August 6th through 9.
Good morning to each one of you. It's a good morning. It's the last morning. And this morning, we'd like to look at the topic of relating to the local community. We all live in a different community, and I found it interesting this week as we went around getting to know each other. Everyone had their name tag, and a lot of you have where you come from. And that actually helped me to identify a few people and make a few connections. So I realized there are about as many communities represented here as people sitting together this morning. And I'd like to look at the Word of God. I'd like to look at this topic. And again, I appreciated the opening comments. So well defined where our help comes from. I'd like to start with two little quotes that I remind myself of periodically because it just gives me a lot of hope and it gives me the perspective that we need. The first one goes like this, that all the darkness in the world is not enough to snuff out the light of one little candle. And the second one is very much like the first, and that is that when light comes, darkness always flees. You see, light has more power than darkness. And even though darkness is big and scary, just a little bit of light makes darkness run to the corners of the room. So we're thinking this morning of light, and I've taken the 5 points that you have on your sheet from the passage in Matthew 5, the teachings of Jesus, and we know them as the Beatitudes. We're not going to read the Beatitudes this morning, but I find this Sermon on the Mount so important for what we do and how we minister, because Jesus addresses all the relevant and important aspects of community living and social life in these 3 chapters. This is something that I'd like to use to kind of develop our perspective before we go into these main points. And I have not seen this since grade school. I was probably in grade 4 or 5. And if I remember correctly, it was a visiting evangelist that drew this on the board. And I would have liked to have been able to draw it on the blackboard for you this morning. But this was quicker and probably better for this application. He explained that we're lights and we get that light from God. And so we have the Son here, the Son of God, who lights up our lives, and those little crosses or plus signs could represent people, but they don't necessarily represent people. They represent people in the sense that one of those might be your school, one of those might be your church, one of those might be the bakery that's run by one of the people in your church, one of those might be the things you do, or that we do as a Christian community or as the body of Christ in a geographical area. One of those may be the things we say. One of those things may be how we relate to people, and on and on. So those are the things that affect the other half, which is the darkness and the world. And the little circles with something missing is made to represent people that are different colors and different kinds. We could have gone different sizes and different shapes, but they all have something missing. That thing that's missing is Jesus Christ. They're not lighted yet, and we are. They're living in darkness. In Matthew 5, 13 to 16 says, "You are the salt of the earth. But if the salt loses its flavor, how can it be made salty again? It is no longer good for anything except to be thrown out and trampled on by people. You are the light of the world. A city located on a hill cannot be hidden. People do not light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all in the house. In the same way, let your light shine before people, so they can see your good deeds and give honor to your Father in heaven." And I think that's where I so often lose it. I'm content when people admire me or the things I do. That's not the point. The point is that they honor our Father, which is in heaven. And so we can do things that affects our light. And I'd like you just for a minute, before we go on to the other points that we have this morning, try to cross the line, go over into the other side, and look at the light through their eyes. I don't know if I can explain it because it's an idea. And I sometimes have trouble explaining what I'm trying to think. But I often try to stand back and look at our school there in El Chal, Guatemala, or our church, or I try to look at myself through my neighbor's eyes. What does he see? When I take away all the things that I know and where I come from and how I was raised, and I look at myself and what we do through what he knows and his limited understanding of the Bible and the way he was raised and his culture. You see, a lot of you are working in communities that speak the same language. You are the same color. You might even kind of dress the same. But you may be working with a vastly different culture, perspective, and worldview. So everything we do affects how people see the light. Because we're his hands and we're his feet. Second thought I'd like to leave with you is that the world understands or has a concept of what a Christian should be. They have a real good idea of how you should act. Probably more than you know. I have a friend who moved 2 weeks ago to a new house, into a new community, a medium-sized city. And the first couple days, they were there getting the house ready to move into, and he got to know the neighbor. And they were chatting, and the neighbor invited him over. He said, "Come over for a minute. It was a hot day." And he offered him a beer. He said, "Oh, no, I don't drink." And he said, "Well, I thought you wouldn't, but I thought I'd check." How many times do they think we won't, but they think they'll check? Our students do that. Children do it to parents. And the world does it to Christians. They have a real good idea. And I wonder, how often have I let them down? I remember years ago, and this is hard for me to admit, but it was probably 20 years ago, or 15, we were here at Faith Builders. My family had come, if I remember correctly, it was for like a music colloquy. And I didn't want to be here, but that's beside the point. We had just pulled into the driveway when another car came and stopped, kind of on the road, just out in front of Faith Builders. And the man got out, and he was mad. And he was asking who was driving the pickup. Well, we didn't know, because the pickup was already there when we got here. He was complaining, I don't really understand it, but apparently one of the young men that was also attending the meeting that day had come in his pickup truck. The man said he was doing 80 miles an hour through town. He was very upset. And he knew that Christians shouldn't drive like that. And I'm not here to criticize him at all. I'm probably guilty of the same thing. The point I'm trying to make is that everything we do, everything affects this picture. How they see the sun. I believe a Christian school can be used as a tool to reach out to the lost around us. Once again, write down what's useful to you. Make it personal. I believe that a Christian school can reach the young for Christ and future service. So no matter how many disadvantages that youngster may have from home, he may live in a very troubled home. That's okay. It's part of his preparation. I believe that. And as a teacher, we're maybe his only chance. And I don't want to overemphasize the work that we need to do, because I believe more and more, I'm understanding more and more, that it's not so much about me. It's about what God is doing through me. But we have to be vessels. We have to be willing to be used. And a teacher may be one of his only chances to get that chance to change, to use his disadvantages as an advantage. You see, I believe that all of us were born into this world for a special purpose. We have a job to do that only we can do. And everything, every part of our lives is ordained to help us do that job. Even the disadvantages, even the problems, even my weaknesses, God wants to use them for his honor and glory. I believe that the Christian school can often be a neutral point of contact between the church and the community. There are a lot of people that will not darken the door of your church, but they'd come to an activity at your school if you'd invite them. So it can be a safe place where you can meet them. And I don't think it's good enough to say, well, they came to our fundraiser. Well, that was great, you know, success. No, get them to church. But it's a point of contact. It's where you get to know them and where they fit in the community. I believe Christian schools can be used to prepare missionaries and Christian workers. So you may say, you know, I'd really like to go into service somewhere. I'd like to go over to Romania or Nigeria. I'd like to do something to reach the Muslims. Well, do you know what? I would too. I really would. But we have to remember as teachers that maybe we're called to equip the people that are going to go to the Muslims. What am I doing today? We have to stand back, like Brother Gerald was saying, and see the big picture. As I heard that, I thought of an example of that. When you learn to drive, we tend to look, at least I did, right at the end of the hood. And it's hard to steer straight. Because we're careful that the car isn't going to go over the yellow line or over the white line. And we go over both. The first thing I tell my boys, when I'm teaching them how to drive, I say, look out there, like at least one hydro pole, electric pole, down the road. Look out beyond and just aim the car for that point. Now, you've got to realize what's between you and that point, but it really helps you steer. And I would say the same thing here. Look out beyond. Look out at the possibilities. And realize that if you have 10 students in your class, you can multiply yourself and your influence times 10. If you have 15 students, you can multiply yourself by 15. I believe that the Christian school can connect community families and lead them to Christ. Now, in our school, it used to be a church school. It's no longer a church school. It was a lot easier to control when it was a church school. We had a lot less problems. We had to work less. And I don't have the answers for that in your community, but I believe that schools and education can be a way to reach people for Christ. People that otherwise may have just floated past us. First point on your sheet is to be a peacemaker. Matthew 5, verse 9 says, "Blessed are the peacemakers, for they will be called the children of God." You will be identified as a child of God when you make peace. And there's a lot of ways to do that. We should seek the peace. I think it was Bono, a rock star, that said, "The wicked make so much noise. The godly are oddly still. We're the quiet in the land." And I ask myself sometimes, I wonder, are we too quiet? We're called to bring peace. Jesus, it's God's will for his children to bring peace to situations. And I understand that there are some situations where you can't have peace. That's why I think the Apostle Paul wrote, he said, "As much as lies within you, live peaceably. As much as you can, be at peace." It identifies us as God's children. And lasting peace only comes from God. That's the only place we can get it. And just like love, and just like forgiveness that I find in my own strength, I can't give. So peace, I need to get from God in order to be able to give it to others. Great opportunities are often disguised as problems. So if you have an issue, try to, once again, look beyond the issue. Look beyond the problem. Ask God, "What kind of opportunities are you giving me here? What do you want me to learn? What do you want me to do? What can I achieve for you through this mess?" We need to proclaim the gospel. There's a story that I tried to find. I couldn't, and so I'll tell it. It's just a short little story about a very experienced preacher, part of a monastery, and he invited one of the young monks one day to accompany him the next day to preach in a town far away. So he said, "We're going to have to get up early, and we'll walk there, and we'll preach for the day." So they got up when it was still dark, and they walked. And when the sun was high in the sky, they arrived in the village. And they went to the market, and they bought some things, some food, and they took it to a poor family. And then they stopped by, and they prayed for an old sick lady. And then they went through the square and they ate their lunch and they talked to some people there. And then they bought some provisions for the monastery and they walked home. And they were almost home when the young monk remembered. He said, "You said we were going to preach." And the old wise man said, "We've been preaching all day." Now, some people say, you know, preach at all times, and if necessary, use words. And I agree. I think that we speak by our actions, but we should also speak with our mouths. You see, often I don't know what to say. I see things. Do you get involved or don't you? The Bible says that if we confess Christ with our mouths, He's going to confess us before his Father. We need to put in that word. I think it's proper and it's right to speak. But I also have said, ever since I was probably 18 or 19, I think we witness the most when we don't even realize someone's watching. People are often watching us. In your list of ideas and tips for teaching, I think toward the end you can find modeling. We should model being wrong. We should model not knowing. And in the world that we live in our communities, we should model getting angry. And we should model failing. And we should model being offended. You know, we tend to think of those things as negative things. They're opportunities. People are watching us more than we know. Paul said, your lives are a letter. Ye are our epistle, written in our hearts, known and read of men. It reminded me of a poem. You've probably seen it. You've probably read it. I am my neighbor's Bible. He reads me when we meet. Today he reads me in my home, tomorrow in the street. He may a relative or friend or slight acquaintance be. He may not even know my name, yet he is reading me. And pray, who is this neighbor who reads me day by day to learn if I am living right and walking as I pray? Oh, he is with me always to criticize or blame, so worldly wise in his own eyes, and sinner is his name. Dear Christian friends and sisters, if we could only know how faithfully the world records just what we say and do, oh, we would write our record plain and come in time to see our worldly neighbor won to Christ while reading you and me. Right at the end, I want to give you some practical pointers of how to plug in to your community. And I'm sure you all have lots of ideas. I would have loved to just bring a chalkboard here instead and have someone write down all your practical ideas. See, there's 100 ways, 1,000 ways that we can do this. When a person comes to Christ, and I've thought of this when I help someone find Christ. You know, you pray with them and they become a Christian and you get to see that birth, that new birth, that new life. You get to see the change. It's amazing. But I always think of all the people that possibly influenced that life before that moment. Or how was it in your experience? How did you come to Jesus? Was it because one Tuesday morning you got up and said, you know what? I got to change some things here. I think I'm going to give my heart to the Lord. No. Our parents, our teachers, and especially people that don't grow up in a Christian setting, there are so many things, little things, that draw them to God. It's not us. But it is what we do. God uses us in situations to speak to people. I have a friend who 12 years ago had no idea who Jesus was. He had heard the word used wrongly in bad language. But he did not know that Jesus was God's son, and he's an American. He grew up, I think, in Wisconsin. And see, that's hard for me to believe. Because on your money, it says, in God we trust. And in my way of thinking, if you know about God, you know about Jesus. But he did not know who Jesus was or what he had done for him. He was living a very sinful life, a sad life. He was racing motorcycles He was involved in like motocross racing. His marriage was in shambles. A friend of his wife's invited her to her baptism. That's all she did. She said, "Lisa, would you come and be present at my baptism?" And so they went. And something happened in Lisa that day. Whatever it was, she said, "I want that." And so she became a Christian, and she started talking to my friend James. James didn't want anything to do with it. And I don't know his whole story, but he told me that it wasn't until he was about at the end of his rope, separated from his wife, living with another woman, drunk most of the time, that he finally gave up and gave in. And I met him in Guatemala. He was down on a work team, on an eye team, bringing sight to poor Guatemalans that couldn't afford to go to the eye doctor. But their goal was not to do eye work. Their goal was to help the people see Jesus. He is so passionate about having others learn about Jesus because it changed his life. Whenever I think of my friend James, I think of that song, and I found out recently it's an old song, like maybe from the 1800s. "I am not skilled to understand what God has willed, what God has planned. I only know at his right hand stands one who is my Savior." Jesus came for the lost, and he wants to use us to reach them. How then will they call on him in whom they have not believed? How will they believe in him whom they have not heard? And how will they hear without a preacher? You can be a preacher in your classroom. You can tell the people at the grocery store. And you don't have to do it in an obnoxious way. You see, I see street preachers sometimes, and it just makes me want to cross the street and go on the other side of the road. I don't know if you know what I mean. This is Jesus' command to his disciples and his will for us today, that we would go and teach all nations, that we'd baptize them in the name of the Father and the Son and the Holy Ghost. We would teach them to observe all things that he's commanded us. And the last part to me is just amazing. He's going to be with us all the time. One night I was helping a boy from our school with his homework. He was from a troubled home. His family was very dysfunctional. And I was helping him with his homework, finishing up, and he was just quiet. And all at once, I felt like I should ask him if he wanted to give his heart to God, because he had been going to our school, he had been hearing about God, and he had been hearing about changed lives. He was probably 13 or 14. And he said, yeah, that's what he wants. And so we prayed together. And then the next day was Saturday and Sunday. And Monday morning, I had devotions in his classroom. And often before I go into devotions, I say, so, everybody have a good weekend. What did you do this weekend? He did not only raise his hand, he stood up. He said, well, I just want to tell my class that on the weekend, I became a Christian. I'm a new person. It was amazing to me because God was obviously working in his heart. If you look at Matthew 15, 32 to 37, this is the account of Jesus feeding the 4,000. I know that we're really familiar with those stories of Jesus feeding the people. But there were some things that I found absolutely amazing. And I think they could be principles in our work. Jesus said to the disciples in modern language, I don't want to send them away hungry. They're hungry. I know it. If you read the account, I think they had been there for 3 days. And he said, they have a need. I want to fill that need before they go. And I challenge you to fill the need that's represented in each one of those little desks this year before they go at the end of the term. He asked his disciples how much they had. To me, that's key. He asked them how much they had. Why didn't he just say, okay, they're hungry. Phew. Everybody had a piece of bread in their hand and a fish. No, he said, how much do you have? Well, they had very little. They answered, we have 7 loaves, I guess, and a few little fishes. And then Jesus gave thanks. And see, I believe that we should be thankful for the little that we have. Because if we're not thankful for the little bit that we have, we're never going to get more. So be thankful for the little bit. And he broke them. He multiplied them. And what just thrilled me is that he gave it back to the disciples. He said, here, you hand it out. And I thought of the many times when God has done the same thing. I have so little. I give it to him. He blesses it. He gives it back. And I really think he expects big results. Well, the disciples got it that day. The disciples gave it to the multitude. They all ate. They were all full. They were satisfied. The need was met. And there was a whole lot left over. That's the God we serve. That's Jesus who promised that he would go with us wherever we need to go. He would help us to teach. I believe that we're called on to be protectors. Now, this isn't real easy to see in the Beatitudes unless you stand back again and look at them from a distance. But if you read down through, blessed are the poor in spirit, for the kingdom of heaven belongs to them. Blessed are those who mourn. Blessed are the meek. Blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Blessed are the merciful. Blessed are the pure in heart. We need to reach out to those people, and oftentimes I think we're called to protect. How to do that? Well, I think you're going to have to take it case by case. Every situation is probably a little bit different. But I think, first of all, we can show them that there's a better way. We can give them hope that their situation can change. We should protect the young and the innocent. And I would just say that there's probably a whole lot more going on out there than we would ever realize. If we ask God to open our eyes to what we can't see, I believe he will. We have to be ready to take action, not in our own strength, but do what he asks us to do. We should reach out to the less fortunate, the rejected, and the abused. See, there's probably somebody in your class that doesn't feel very confident. Make sure that they find a safe place in your classroom. Matthew 5, 11 and 12 are verses that I don't understand completely. But I've come to believe that this is a test that God gives every one of his workers, every one of his disciples. And from my experience, it's the toughest test that I've taken. It's when we do good and it creates conflict. Blessed are ye when men shall revile you and persecute you and shall say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. You might say, I can't believe that they're lying about me. Well, thank God they're lying. At least they're not telling the truth, because that would mean you're wrong. You know, when people misrepresent you, that's tough. It's very hard. I find it devastating. But remember, at least they're misrepresenting you. It's not accurate what they're saying. The tough thing is that it's maybe only 3 degrees off, and they're going to confuse some other people. But at least they're misrepresenting. It's not true. He goes on to say that we should rejoice and be exceeding glad, for our reward is great. Great is your reward in heaven. For so persecuted they the prophets which were before you. And I have a question that I don't know that I can answer. But I wonder if every one of Jesus' disciples has to pass this test. Where they're misrepresented, they're misunderstood, they're lied about, they're persecuted, they're taken wrongly, and they have to rejoice and say, you know, God, you take care of it. It's okay. It's all right. I'm willing to let people think whatever they want to of me. It's okay. I know that it's for your glory. So I'm just going to trust you with that. You take it. I'm not going to write letters. I'm not going to try to get people to see things differently. I'm just going to trust you. People misunderstand us. People may even say things that they don't mean to try us out. We work with people, our coworkers, the other people in our community, they're Christians, but we don't always act like a Christian should. I don't always act like I should. There are people that you may work with. They may be co-workers. They may be Christian school teachers that are really, really struggling. You may be the person that can help them find their way. I was reminded of a poem that has bothered me for years because I rode with a young man to work every day when I was younger. And I had a real burden for his soul. And I would pray for him, and I would pray for him, but he was so cool. I found it very, very hard to talk to him about God. He went to church. He went to the same church I did. But we both knew he wasn't doing well. It goes like this. My friend, by D.J. Higgins. My friend, I stand in judgment now and feel that you're to blame somehow. While on this earth I walked with you day by day, and never did you point the way. You knew the Lord in truth and glory, but never did you tell the story. My knowledge then was very dim. You could have led me safe to him. Though we lived together here on earth, you never told me of your second birth, and now I stand this day condemned because you failed to mention him. You taught me many things, that's true. You called me friend, and I trusted you. But now I learned, now it's too late. You could have kept me from this fate. We walked by day and talked by night, and yet you showed me not the light. You let me live and love and die, and all the while you knew I'd never live on high. Yes, I called you friend in life, and trusted you in joy and strife. Yet in coming to this end, I see you really weren't my friend. So often I don't say things because I don't want to be taken wrongly. Or I don't want to get people upset or make them uncomfortable. And sometimes when they're living wrong, they're just going to have to be uncomfortable. And how do we speak the truth in love? That's part of the light that we're supposed to shine. Some practical ideas for doing things, for connecting with your community. Once again, write down what's useful to you. And I'm sure there's a lot of other ideas that we could mention. But some things you could do with your classroom, or your class, or your school, is to plan an afternoon of singing for an old person. person or some old people in your community, or go visit some people that are shut-ins or are sick. They are a receptive audience. They're looking for someone to come by. They will be glad to give you time. I think in doing this, we can accomplish several things at once. I was reading recently about churches being compelling churches. And the community sees what we do. And if we can serve the community, they will be convinced that we are a group of people that they would like to be a part of. And there were some ideas there. And applying it to this situation, you could maybe adopt a park. Just down from our school, there's a water or a well, a public well, where people come to haul water. Some of the ladies come to wash their clothes and the children bath down there. And we've kept it chopped as a school and partly as a mission effort. It's just a piece of public ground that's just real close to us, and we run our lawnmower over there too. And people appreciate it. And a couple of years ago, there was some conflict about that piece, and some people said, well, you know, you guys don't have any say on that public piece. Well, it's a public piece of ground. Everyone in town can use it. And so we stopped mowing it for a while. Was that the right attitude? I don't think so. You could pick up the garbage in littered areas or along a stretch of road. And there are probably other better ideas that you could apply to your situation. But do something in the community. Let's not just be concerned with what's inside our fence. Too often, that's how we think. Let's reach out. That's part of reaching, is to get out of our little square. This is a new one, and the more I think about it, the better I like it. Paint a mural or a sign with an evangelistic message or a thought-provoking message. There's a trucking company close to where I stay in Canada, and they often have something on a sign out by the highway. And thousands of people see that sign before it's changed. I think the one that was there just before I came was, "It wasn't raining when Noah built the ark." You know, they're not being aggressive. But it wasn't raining when Noah built the ark. And I thought about it, and I thought about it, and I'm still not sure if I know exactly what all that's saying. If you want to get involved in people's lives a little more directly, maybe take another step in. You could have your students interview different people in the community as part of a research project. If you're studying a time in history or some of the world wars, have your students find a soldier, an old soldier, or somebody that remembers those times, and have them go and interview them. Have them talk with them. Maybe they can do it in a group. It's going to mean more work for you, but it's going to get you involved in the community, especially an older person. Rest assured that when Johnny calls him, he's going to tell his son about the little Christian school that came to visit him, because it's going to change his day. It's going to be the highlight, maybe, of his week or month. I'd encourage any school to plan a fundraiser night, where the goal is not to raise funds. You see, a fundraiser is safe. Anybody can go to a fundraiser. So you put up some maybe signs around town that on such an evening or such an afternoon, we're going to have a fundraiser here at the school. Would you please come? And they come and make it your goal to reach out to the community, to get to know people that attend that thing. Make connections. Figure out where they live. Get to know your families that are just right around your school. And some ideas, I guess, for that. I'm sure there are some better ones, but you could plan a car wash. People maybe need their cars washed. You could plan a couple supper around Valentine's Day, you know, where they pay so much, and you just serve them some good cooking in one of your biggest rooms at the school. Get to know them. They come your way, you go their way, and you have that connection then. And follow up on it. Different ideas for auctions. Pies and cakes and bread. Good used items, or crafts or wood projects. And you might make a little bit of money, and most Christian schools can use that. But that's not the goal. That's not the deal. Up in Canada, in the area where I live, I'd like to know more about it, but I don't know that Google is really going to help me on this one. But they have an Amish school sale, and it is a big deal. Now, it did not start that way. It started very small. They make thousands of dollars with that thing. The whole community, even the people that aren't Amish, or remotely Amish, or have nothing to do with the Amish, are there involved. If I'm not mistaken, this past year, they just had it, there were 4 or 5 auctioneers going solid from 8 to 4. And then the one, my friend that was helping to auctioneer, he had to go home and chore, but the other auctioneers kept going for a while. But we're not taking turns among the 4 or the 5. We've got 4 or 5 going strong. We've got somebody selling over here, somebody selling over here. It's just mounds of stuff. It's huge. And some people donate it, and some people give it to them at their cost, and they sell it all, and it goes for the Amish school. Some outreach options with maybe a more evangelistic twist is a children's club, and I think children's clubs are good if there's a bit of follow-up. If there are some people behind the young people that are working with the children, if there can be a pastor or some mature people that can then disciple their parents. See, it's a dark world out there. There's a lot of misery. And we can try to alleviate that suffering by taking the child out of his home and letting him color some pictures for an hour or two. But what I believe Christ is calling us to do is lead the people to him who fills everything completely. A youth afternoon or an evening, a ladies' Bible study. I think you'd be surprised how many ladies would be open to sitting down and study the Bible. We're not studying Mennonite doctrine yet. We're studying the Bible. What does the Bible say to them? The Bible is a living book. It transcends all culture and all time, and it has answers for you and your neighbor today. Could plan a men's breakfast. You're going to want to do some follow-up. Or maybe a sports event. I talked to a fellow that goes over to, I wish I could remember. I'm going to say like Thailand or something like that. It's way over. And they play hockey. And then during whatever they call that, between periods in hockey? Intermission. One of their guys goes over to the other team's dressing room and they do a Bible study. But that's their mission trip. Maybe some of you want to sign up. What I'd like to say, I'm not doing a promo for them. I'm saying, why don't we do more of that? Can we? Are we strong enough? I'd like to close with a story. I feel like I've just maybe asked questions and given a few random ideas. When Jesus was sending out his 12 disciples, he said to them like this, "I am sending you out like sheep surrounded by wolves, so be wise as serpents and innocent as doves. Beware of people, because they will hand you over to councils and flog you in their synagogues, and you will be brought before governors and kings because of me, as my witness to them and the Gentiles." So it's pretty scary out there. Be careful, but be filled with Christ. There's a story about a man named Sadhu, who was a Hindu that was converted to Christianity. He became a missionary to his people in India. Late one afternoon, Sadhu was traveling on foot through the Himalayas with a Buddhist monk. It was bitterly cold and the wind felt like sharp blades slicing into their skins. Night was fast approaching when the monk warned Sadhu that they were in danger of freezing to death if they did not reach the monastery before darkness. Suddenly, on a narrow path above a steep precipice, they heard a cry for help. At the foot of the cliff lay a man, fallen and badly hurt. The monk, the Buddhist monk, looked at Sadhu and said, "Do not stop. God has brought this man to his fate. He must work it out for himself. Let us hurry on before we too perish." But Sadhu replied, "God has sent me here to help my brother. I cannot abandon him." The monk continued trudging off through the swirling snow, while the missionary clambered down the steep embankment. The injured man's leg was broken and he could not walk, so Sadhu made a sling of his blanket and tied the man on his back. With great difficulty, he climbed back up the cliff, drenched now in perspiration. Doggedly, Sadhu made his way through the deepening snow and darkness. It was all he could do to follow the path. But he persevered, though faint with fatigue and overheated from the exertion. Finally, he saw the lights of the monastery. Then for the first time, Sadhu stumbled and nearly fell. But not from weakness. He had stumbled over an object lying in the snow-covered road. Slowly he bent down on one knee and brushed the snow off the object. It was the body of the Buddhist monk frozen to death. Years later, a disciple of Sadhu's asked him, "What is life's most difficult task?" Without hesitation, Sadhu replied, "To have no burden to carry." May God bless you.
For more free resources that support teaching and learning, visit thedocforlearning.org.